Well, we've been going through this series on Elisha. I keep getting more and more excited each time I go through the next one. There's a lot in these lessons about Elisha. He's just a fascinating life. I love so many of the tie-ins, especially possibly with end-time events, things that might happen. We'll see as time progresses. But this afternoon, we're going to continue to look at these lessons from Elisha's life. This is part four. As we go through this, part four, the first part, we looked at the first four miracles. The part two, we went through the next five. So we've up to nine there. And then we had two more in part three with Naaman and Gehazi. And today, I'm hoping we're going to get to we're going to get through four, and there'll be one left. And I'm hoping we'll be able to conclude it with part five next time. But it's exciting. If you turn over to 2 Kings chapter 6, in chapter 5 last time we went through Naaman, his leprosy, and Gehazi, two miracles that occur in this chapter, a lot in those stories, both of them. But it's interesting, we're not even going to get through chapter 6 today, and we're going to hit four miracles in a little over half of a chapter. Here we pick up in verse 1, 2 Kings 6, verse 1. And the sons of the prophet said to Elisha, "See now, the place where we dwell with you is too small for us." This phrase, son of the prophets, is one I've read over a few times, and it finally struck me when I was reading another book on this. We've gone through at least three points where it's mentioned, son of the prophets. I don't know, I just kind of read over it thinking, okay, son of the prophets. But it's an interesting phrase. I was looking up in Manners and Customs of the Bible, an interesting book by James Freeman. Kind of goes through different manners, customs that maybe you take for granted or you think you know. And it goes through and explains at that time what it was. It says this about the sons of the prophet. It says, the disciples of the prophets were called sons. So another word for disciples. They were called sons, as teachers are sometimes called fathers. These quote-unquote sons of the prophet formed a peculiar order whose mission seemed to have been to assist the prophets in their duties and in time to succeed them. They were not, as we look at, monks of today. They weren't these monks going around humming and having nothing to do with other people. It wasn't that, but it had an interesting, more of like theological students. They would study under the prophets and learn from them, and maybe in time, if God was working with them, they might be a prophet in the future if they were continually following God. But they probably studied the law, history of God's people, had time where they had more time to study and go through these, but they were more devoted toward it. Maybe similar to where Samuel's life was when he was a kid. His mother, Hannah, gives him to the priest to kind of raise and be devoted to studying God's law. And you see Eli and Samuel in the same house, or the same building at least, and Eli, you know, he's down the hall or wherever they're at, and Samuel's, "Oh, did you need me?" "No, no, I didn't call you," repeatedly, three times. And, "Oh, God's talking to you." So you kind of see in the same building type atmosphere for some of these anyway. And we see here that this dwelling place was getting too small for them in verse 1. It's interesting as we look at these sons of the prophets more or less being disciples of the prophets, learning from them. Freeman's book continues. It says, this school of the prophets, other kind of term for it, in which these sons, quote unquote, were trained, are supposed to have been founded by the prophet Samuel, though their origin and history are involved in obscurity. There's no place in Scripture that says for sure, but it's thought that it might have began or been around the time of the prophet Samuel. And it's repeated a lot. We'll turn to a few of those over in 1 Samuel 19. You can hold your place here. We'll be back and forth. And for me, it was one of those phrases, you know, you just kind of read, okay, the sons of the prophets. But to kind of look at them, the disciples of the prophets, kind of a school where they studied together. They really devoted themselves to learning more about God. 1 Samuel 19, we see David fled to Ramah. 1 Samuel 19, beginning in verse 18. So David fled and escaped and went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. He's fleeing from his persecution from Saul, literally Saul trying to kill the man. And he said, and he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth. Now it was told Saul, saying, "Take note, David is at Naoth in Ramah." Then Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the group of prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. We see this take place over and over as you go through the rest of this chapter. But we see this group of prophets. Samuel was the head of them, where it may have been one of the origins of it. But we see David kind of fleeing to them to help him, or at least to tell them the story. But we see this Ramah come up several times. We see it come up here. Over in 2 Kings chapter 2, I guess Ramah doesn't come up here, but it will be mentioned in other places. But here we see Jericho mentioned. We've covered this in Elijah's sermons that we went through. 2 Kings chapter 2, in verse 7. Talking about Jordan here in verse 6, and 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood facing them at a distance, while the two of them stood by the Jordan River. They see Elijah as he is taken up and moved to a different location, but taken up into the clouds. So we see 50 men here in Jericho area. And it goes through several more in these verses to follow. But we again see this kind of school of the prophets. 50 of them mentioned here. Also in chapter 4, verse 38, we see where the pot of stew is purified. We see in verse 38, Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in the land. Now the sons of the prophets were sitting before him. And he said to his servant, "Put on the large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets." We see Elisha around them on numerous occasions here. This is another one of them. And sometimes people, well, this must be kind of like a priest where they can't marry. So this is just them being celibate. Well, that's easy to refute because we go back up to verse 1. 2 Kings 4, verse 1. Another miracle we went through, a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor is coming to take away my two sons to be his slaves." So didn't mean that they didn't have wives, but some of them didn't, and they lived all in one area. Others, like this one, had wives, had a wife and raised kids. Normal life, but you start to see what their attitude was. We see this miracle that goes around or follows this widow of one of the sons of the prophets. Kind of interesting as you look at, I've just read over sons of the prophets so many times, and you look at what it is. They were learning to be prophets, which was a good thing, but also an easy thing to be corrupted at times as well. You see repeatedly prophets coming before kings, telling them what God did not say. Usually it was, "Oh, you're going to be prosperous. There's not going to be famine. It's going to be peace, peace." And there would be no peace. So at times it became a bad thing. Another area over in Amos, hold your place still here in 2 Kings. One of those fun books to find, Hosea, Joel, Amos. I can usually hit one of those books when I open it to that area. Amos chapter 7. Because I love Amos' story a lot in this book. And you look at him prophesying, it was not met with receptive words. It was not favored. And part of people didn't like, well, Amos, he wasn't part of the sons of the prophets. Well, he specifically mentions that here in Amos 7, verse 14. Says, "Then Amos answered and said to Amaziah, 'I was no prophet, nor was I a son of a prophet, but I was a herdsman, and a tender of sycamore fruit. Then the Lord took me as I followed the flock, and the Lord said to me, go prophesy to my people Israel. It doesn't say in this area, but maybe there was some perversion. The sons of the prophet weren't following anymore. It doesn't necessarily mean that, but God had to go out and find a herdsman, Amos, and tell him, here's what I want you to tell my people. Here's what you have to go tell them. And it took going to a shepherd, as we see happen before, going to David, bringing up a king, finding someone who was still following God. Amos was that way. Quite an interesting statement about Amos. So it's kind of interesting as a side note as we look at this sons of the prophets, what they were. They were disciples of the prophets, trying to learn from them. You kind of see that from Elisha. He was learning from Elijah, and he was following God as well. And we see this. So back over in 2 Kings chapter 6, again in verse 1, we see these sons of the prophet talking to Elisha. See now, the place where we dwell with you is too small for us. So in some instances, they were unmarried, occupied a building in common, as we see here. And so they asked, well, it's too small for us. Verse 2, please let us go to the Jordan, going to the Jordan River, and let us every man take a beam from there, and let us make there a place where we may dwell. So they're asking Elisha's permission. Here's what we'd like to do. Is this okay? And he answers, go. Verse 2, and he said, please consent to go with us. One said, please consent to go with your servants. And he answered, I will go. So they ask him, we want you with us. We don't want to go by ourselves. Please come with us. And he agrees. So they all go to the Jordan River to cut down trees to build a bigger place for their home. Verse 3 continues. Verse 4, so he went with them, and when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water. And he cried out and said, alas, master, for it was borrowed. One of these sons of the prophets had borrowed this. You start to think, oh, come on, it's an axe. They're pretty common now. You start to think, well, were they pretty expensive back then? Iron wasn't extremely common. Was it difficult to have one? In this case, they borrowed it from someone else. Whether the sons of the prophets probably weren't very rich, didn't have a lot of money to begin with. We see them. I just borrowed this. I got to return this to the guy. It's kind of interesting as we look at this iron axe. It's mentioned throughout Scripture, or at least axe, and you don't really think of it maybe in that instance. Over in Ecclesiastes chapter 10, I've done some bit of axe work, and you think, I've had the tip fall off of my axe, and it's good to see it wasn't just me. You're chopping away, and all of a sudden you see it getting looser and looser, ready to get the end, and you got to pound it on the ground and get it back on there. And we see this happen over and over. From what we can tell, this is what happened to the sons of the prophet here. Ecclesiastes chapter 10 has a few things to say about axe here. Verse 9, Ecclesiastes 10, verse 9, he who quarries stone may be hurt by them, and he who splits wood may be endangered by it. Even today, it's not something you just goof off with. You've got to be careful. I've seen people that have lost toes because they've chopped them off, or the head's flown off and hit somebody. We see this as well as a dangerous thing to do. Verse 10, if the axe is dull and the one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength. But wisdom brings success. You don't just keep chopping with a dull axe. You sharpen it and get the work done. I don't know. Does this really need to be in Scripture? But it's something significant, something that is included here. So much so that it's even mentioned back in Deuteronomy. It's mentioned here in Deuteronomy chapter 19. Discussed in this chapter three cities of refuge. The idea was that if you accidentally killed, it wasn't that you went out and murdered someone. But you're working, you're doing something, and something happens, and you accidentally kill someone. There was a city of refuge, one of the three that you could go to flee. You hopefully tried to explain to the family, this was an accident, I did not mean this, and you tried to let them know. But if they didn't agree, and they thought that you did this intentionally for whatever reason, they could then come out and kill you. But if you were in the city of refuge, one of these three, you were fine. They couldn't touch you. You stepped one foot outside of that city, they had that right. So we see this mentioned here in chapter 19, and it specifically mentions an axe. Verse 5, pick it up in verse 4, says, this is the case of the manslayer who flees there that he may live. Whoever kills his neighbor unintentionally, not having hated him in time past. As when a man goes to the woods with his neighbor to cut timber, and his hand swings a stroke and the axe to cut down the tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor so that he dies. He shall flee to one of these cities and live. We see it was something dangerous, something even mentioned in Deuteronomy, which I hadn't really thought of either as I was researching this. Kind of interesting. Iron, this axe gets mentioned as well in the New Testament as well, kind of with a judgment period mentioned. But we see here this axe back in 2 Kings chapter 6. We see it fall into the river, into the water, here in the Jordan. And it was borrowed. Verse 6, it says, and the man of God said, where did it fall? Elisha answers back, where did it go? I find it interesting, Elisha, he has a kind heart. He could have easily had any kind of remark here. He could have said, why were you so close to the river? You should know an axe head will fall off at times. Why were you so close? He could have said, why weren't you more careful? Instead, he says, where did it go? What part? You start to think, well, come on, it falls in a river. You just kind of get in that area. It's an axe. It's an axe head. How far could it go? But it isn't that simple. I remember several years ago, we were back in Illinois. We had a church picnic. We used to have a lake we all went to, a family by the name of Sourball. So the place we went, we called it Sourball Lake. We went and enjoyed water skiing. I had a water slide there. And one of our girls, I think Emma was two or three at that point, so I took her down the water slide and get to the bottom, and I forgot my glasses were still on. And here you're in the pond, a lake, and you get down there. Well, you're going to either hold my girl or hold my glasses. I picked my girl. But I can still picture them going off my fingers into the water and still feeling them for that last time and thinking, I'm blind as a bat without my glasses. And we just happened to have someone who had scuba diving equipment. I have no idea why he had it there. It wasn't that big of a lake. But he went down for an hour looking. He could not find them. Looked everywhere. Here you have scuba diving equipment. How quickly and how easily things can be lost. And this was not a river. The river here in Jordan was very deep and rapid near the Jordan and Jericho area. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown states how deep and rapid it was. And so you start to think, here it is, it's gone. It's lost. But Elisha says, where did it fall? And he showed him the place. So he cut off a stick. I love this. I want to hear, you know, we're always hearing these idiot scientists, well, I think the Red Sea parted because of this. Well, how do you think the iron floated with a branch? Well, I think there was magnets in the branch. Really? They'd probably come up with something stupid like that. No, God lifted it up. And I find it hysterical that he uses a branch. God put it in Elisha's mind, why don't you grab a branch over there? Let's have some fun with this. And so he takes a branch, boom. The iron lifts up out of the water. These sons of the prophets had to be talking about this for years, talking to their grandkids. Oh, I remember when we were chopping wood and Elisha came down, put a stick in, and here comes the iron straight up. Wow. Didn't have a magnet in his pocket? Nope, we didn't even have magnets back then. Wow. Amazing. And so we see this 12th miracle, iron to swim. Iron swims. It comes up. So he cut this off at a stick, threw it in there, and he made the iron float. Verse 7 is, with all of his miracles, it always seems there's something you have to do. Therefore, he said, pick it up for yourself. Elisha, why don't you do it? You're right there. No, you pick it up. Pick it up for yourself. So he reached out his hand and took it. One of those just amazing ones. I love this one. And you think, how insignificant. Why do you need to have this in there? It's not like a whole army dropped dead. Wow, amazing. Here he brings an axe head that he borrowed. You know, just go buy another one. Give him another one. No. Brings it up, putting a stick in the water. Quite an amazing miracle. And again, this 12th miracle as we've been going through these. Quite a thing to say about Elisha. You see his kindness of heart here in this miracle. Brings us into verse 8. This might be one of my top favorites. I love this one. This story just cracks me up every time I go through it. I love the humor in it. I love the faith in it. A lot in this one. Verse 8. Now the king of Syria, again still Ben-Hadad as we went through last time, was making war against Israel. And he took counsel with his servants, saying, my camp will be in such and such a place. So he tells his servants, here's what we're going to do. We're going to camp out. We're going to kind of sneak up on them. Verse 9, and this man of God sent to the king of Israel, saying, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are coming down there. Very likely this could have been some type of a guerrilla warfare, kind of hiding, ready to pounce. You know, you got a certain thoroughfare where they're constantly coming through, and then you can take them out. Wipe out big sections of their army at a time. So we see them go through this, and we see Elisha talk to the king of Israel. Again, this is Ahab's son. His name's not mentioned, very likely because he's still not following God. That's usually the reason why the name wasn't put in there. And so we see maybe God's trying to keep working with the king. You know, something should start clicking here. Your Baal prophets aren't coming up to you telling you these things. It's Elisha, the one that follows the one true God. And he's telling you things that you should not be able to find out. Secret things. And he tells them, here's where the Syrians are come, don't go down. Maybe not all faith there, because the king wants to say, well, is he true? Verse 10, the king of Israel sent someone to the place of which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, and he was watchful there. Not just once or twice. So at least three times this happens, maybe more. Not once or twice, three times the king of Syria says, oh, here's where we're going to lie in wait. We're going to catch him. And king of Israel says, okay, I found out. He goes, send someone. Yep, there's someone there. At least three times. As you can imagine, this does not go over well. Verse 11. Therefore, the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, will you not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? You know, who's the traitor? This is the only way. And I wonder, it doesn't give much detail here, but, you know, the first time that he had 10 people in his courtroom where he says, okay, here's what we're going to do. Okay, they found out. Okay, one of these 10 has got to be the blabbermouth. Okay, well, I'm just going to get three now. I'm just going to tell a few. And then they find out again. Okay, I'm just going to tell one or two, the ones I can really trust. And it still becomes known. You wonder, but we see him greatly troubled. Which one of you is the traitor? Who's telling them this? It's the only way. But we see Elisha's fame and how far it has spread. Again, Naaman's come back. People in Syria have heard, wow, Naaman had leprosy. He's come back. Who is this guy? Elisha? He's the one who told them to go down to the river to dip three times. Wow. Here's what Elisha's fame is spreading. Not because it's Elisha, but because of God behind him. Verse 12. Again, king is asking them, who's the one telling? Who's the blabbermouth? Verse 12. And one of his servants said, none, my lord. O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." This had to trouble him even more. What do you mean? The most secret area that you can talk. Barnes notes in the Bible says this about your bedroom here. In the most private place, in the greatest possible secrecy. Again, secret place, where no one else should know. Hold your place here back over in Amos. I should have had you hold your place there. My apologies. I didn't hold my place either, so sorry. Amos chapter 3. This gets repeated several times, this secrecy. Again, God knows everything. We see this mentioned here in Amos. I'm in Hosea. Amos chapter 3. This whole chapter going through the authority of the prophet's message. The authority doesn't come because it's the prophet. The authority comes because it comes from God. I'm so sick of these people that proclaim themselves prophets. There's no authority because there's no God behind them. They're, I'm a prophet. I'm one of the two witnesses. I'm. They're not going to be pointing to themselves. They're going to be pointing, here's what God said. I know you're going to hate me. I don't care. Here's what God said. It's not going to be easy. And we see this authority of the prophet's message in verse chapter 3 here, Amos 3. It's in my notes here somewhere, verse 7. "Surely the Lord God does nothing unless he reveals his secret to his servants, the prophets." Again, God reveals the secrets to his prophets, his servants. Quite a bit said about them. But those secrets are revealed to God's servants, his prophets. Also over in Revelation chapter 10. We won't be back to Amos, so you can lose your spot there. Revelation chapter 10. In the midst of these trumpets being described, kind of takes a side note here, and we see this mention here, verse 7, Revelation 10, in verse 7, "But in the days of the sounding of the seventh angel," again, that day of the Lord, that last trumpet to sound, leading up to that last trumpet, "when he is about to sound, the mystery of God would be finished, as he declared to his servants, the prophets." Again, God reveals his secrets. The mystery of God, finished. But the prophet will be the one to tell it. Whether it's the true witnesses, whether there'll be others, it doesn't say at this point, but we see God's servants still are his prophets, those that are serving him and not themselves. We see this over and over of this secrecy. God knows everything. And you start to think, well, even the innermost thoughts. Over in Ecclesiastes 10, bedrooms mentioned here as well, but even more secret than the bedroom. You think, well, how much more secret can you get? Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and verse 20. "Do not curse the king." You know, the same applies to President Obama. You know, we may have, we don't agree, but it's the office that's there. We don't curse that office. "Do not curse the king, even in your thought." You can't get any more secret than that. No one else knows that but you, just your thoughts. God knows those thoughts. "Do not curse the rich, even in your bedroom. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter." Again, God knows all things. You have to be careful. Here we see the king of Syria being told, "In your innermost room, God is revealing your secrets." You don't see much repentance, because I find his remark kind of interesting back in 2 Kings. It's kind of funny. You're told, okay, there's this guy in this other city who knows what you're thinking in your bedroom, or maybe not thinking, but he knows what you're saying in your bedroom, your most private area. He knows this. So what's his reply? Well, you know, I should be humble. I should be going to him, doing what he says, following his God. No, not what he says. Verse 13, so he said, the king of Israel, go and see where he is that I might send and get him. I wonder if his servant kind of rolled his eyes here. Did I not just tell you that he knows your secret things? Do you think he not knows now that we're coming to him? Oh, well, we'll do what you say. But we see this. What are we going to do about this guy? We'll go and get him. Now let's go take care of him. And it was told him, saying, surely he is in Dothan. Dothan, as you look at that map we handed out a few weeks ago, is just above Samaria, probably 10 miles north of Samaria. Samaria, again, the capital of Israel. So 10 miles. It'll come significant because we'll get to the rest of where they go, around 10 miles at least. We see them go find Elisha. In verse 14, therefore he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night surrounding the city. Kind of an interesting statement as you think about surrounding the city. You imagine if you wake up in the morning, tomorrow morning, and you are surrounded by policemen, CIA, FBI, every eye that's around you, all surrounding your house. And you wake up, you get your cup of coffee, and you look out the window, and you're, uh-oh, what happened? This is not, oh, well, let me go make my pancakes now. You start to worry, well, what's going on? What happened? Well, we get a little bit of that here. They go down to that area. Kind of interesting, they go to Dothan. It comes up another place that kind of, when I was reading through that, I'm like, Dothan, I've heard of that before. You can put in your notes Genesis 37, verse 17. Joseph finds his brothers with the flocks in Dothan. Kind of an interesting kind of side note as you look at that area. Joseph finally finding his brothers, and that's Dothan is where he gets sold to Egypt and gets going down to Egypt from that area. But we see this area they're in, and we see them encircled completely around. Verse 15, and when the servant of the man of God arose early, I picture him getting his cup of coffee nowadays, and getting his paper, going out to get the paper in the front yard, and I want to see the picture of his eyes. I imagine they're just as big as saucers. You just, what's this? He looks up and went out, and there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? We're dead meat. We're toast. What are we going to do? Quite an attitude. Maybe some lack of faith here. I don't know. What would we have the same faith if you woke up in the morning and you see this surrounded your house? Do you think, oh, no problem. Let me put the rest, get me another cup of coffee. Or are you, what's happening? What's going on? Hold your place here over in Mark chapter 4. Kind of a similar situation with Christ and his disciples. Mark chapter 4. Mark chapter 4 and verse 35. See Christ teaching the multitudes, giving them the parables, telling them these truths here earlier in this chapter. Verse 35, on the same day when evening had come, he said to them, Christ talked to his disciples, let us cross over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee here. And when they had left the multitude, they took him alone along in the boat as he was. And other little boats were also with him. Kind of interesting too. You got other little boats, so it's like you can't get away. You're in a boat, and you got other little boats. Well, we know he's in that boat, so let's follow. He needs a break. He needs to get his batteries recharged. Again, Christ is human. He's probably exhausted, and we see how quickly he falls asleep. Verse 37. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat, so that it was already filling. And he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow, exhausted. I am in no way comparing a Sabbath for me to Christ. But, you know, after a circuit, I get home and I'm just, I'm spent. The joke at our house is if we put a movie on in the evening after sunset, it's like, well, when's Dad going to fall asleep in it? Because it may be a wonderful movie. I want to see it, and I just fall asleep. And it's just tiring. It's a long day. Nothing wrong with it, but you picture Christ times 50, how many multitudes are constantly around him, healing, helping, doing all these things that he helps with. And he's tired. He falls asleep on the boat. And they go down to wake him up. They woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" His disciples assume that he was asleep, so he didn't care. Wasn't the case, but they lack of faith. Faith was lacking here. Verse 39, "Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Peace, be still.'" Very simple statement. Peace, be still. He doesn't go on words and words. Please calm down, God, just peace, be still. Three simple words. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. Not just a calm, a great calm. You don't have a great calm after a huge storm. It takes a while. You got the ripplings, you've got to wait. Even you got a boat going through near a beach. You get the ripples, it doesn't just calm down. You're waiting for the ripples to come through, and oh, finally, now it'll calm down. It's just boom, a great calm. Quite a miracle. And it gets their attention, as you can imagine. Verse 40, and Christ said to them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" It didn't say, how do you have little faith? It says, how is it you don't have any faith? How long have I been with you? Verse 41, and they feared exceedingly and said to one another, "Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Christ had power over natural forces. Again, Christ has power over natural forces that threaten you. Hurricanes, winds, tornadoes, you name it. There's nothing that limits God. And we see that protection. And we see that reminder. Here are disciples kind of early on. They hadn't been with him as much maybe at this point. We're just in Mark chapter 4, and they're still lacking that faith. It would build in time. You wonder how many times they went back and thought about this. And later, after Christ's death, thinking, man, how did we doubt that? Look at all the things Christ did after that point. We've grown now. How many times did Peter go back and, how did I let Christ down 3 times and deny him? How did I do that? But they all progressed forward. They didn't keep looking back. They kept repenting and they kept moving forward. They increased in faith. But we see them at this point lacking that faith. Very similar to this servant of Elisha. Again, this would have been a new servant. Gehazi had already gotten leprosy. So a new young man that comes in still lacking that faith. Didn't see what was around him. And so we see this attitude. We see this reminder. Again, the disciples had the same lack of faith. We can have it as well. We've got to make sure that we're constantly building that relationship with God, not letting that faith diminish. When we see it diminishing, go to God. Ask for, I'm lacking some faith here. Help me to build this back up. You're seeing a lack of faith, which is positive. It means God's still working with you. Don't let it discourage you. Help you see. Oh, thank you for helping me see it. Help me to keep increasing in that faith. Back in chapter 6 of 2 Kings, we see it continue here. The new servant here, understandably, not sure what to do. "I'll ask my master, what shall we do?" I love Elisha's statement here in verse 16. "So Elisha answered, 'Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them.'" Very simple statement. Don't be afraid. Those that are with us are more than those who are with them. This statement, this calmness that he says. He doesn't, oh, you're right, there is a bunch of people out here. Oh, no, no. He just, it's all right. God's with us. He outnumbers everything. Don't worry about it. But he helps them. But we see this simple statement. If you turn over to Psalm 55, one of those hymns I love, especially the last stanza that comes here from Psalms 55. Psalm chapter 55. I think it's hymn number 33 in our hymnal. But as for me, I'll call on God. I love that last stanza, the middle of it, as it goes through. And this where these words come from. I love this phrase and this reminder. Psalm 55, verse 16. As for me, I will call upon God, and the Lord shall save me. Evening and morning and at noon I will pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. There's a faith here. It's not he might hear it. He shall hear my voice. Verse 18, he has redeemed my soul in peace from the battle which was against me, for there are many against me. Again, the battle around us, the trials we go through, this battle that's against us, there are many against me. Verse 19, God will hear and afflict them. Even he who abides from of old, Selah, because they do not change. Therefore, they do not fear God. There are many around us. You look at our trials, the trials you go through, they can seem insurmountable. They can seem like you're completely surrounded by Satan and his forces. You get up and you just... they're everywhere. But they never outnumber God. They never outnumber God. It's a comfort. It doesn't help as much when you're going through it and you're seeing it, but you have that faith of, okay, God, help me to get through this. Help me to get through this next trial. Health difficulties. Things that happen. Death of a spouse. You talk about being surrounded at the wall. And feeling like, even things that, it's not that big a deal. You think about getting ready for the feast. You start getting big bills coming up, some catastrophe. I think I might have to dip into my second tithe. Well, wait, it's not your second tithe. It's God's. It's holy. It's set apart. And it takes faith to say, God, I don't see how I'm going to get through this. I've got to get into the second tithe, but it's yours. So help, I don't want to take it, and I'm not going to. And it takes faith to say, okay, God, help me to get through these bills. I don't know what's going to happen, but this is your money for the feast, and I'm not touching it. I want to be at the feast. You talk about being surrounded. Oh, that's nothing. Well, tell that to someone that has to go through it. It takes faith to say, God, I can't do it without you. I need you. Help me to get through this. I'm not touching your holy tithe. It takes a lot to go through that, a lot to stick by God and realize God's always there for us. And I love these verses here in verses 16 through 19. As for me, I will call upon God. And when we see those times in our life, those trials that hit us, we go to God. God, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. I don't know how this will happen, but you're with me. Help me get through this. I'm going to be at the feast no matter what. There's times, health difficulties, some things. We've had my grandfather died right before the feast. It didn't work out. My parents couldn't make it to the feast that year. They had to be with the grandma, but it wasn't by choice. Again, we try to be there with every ounce of our being. We follow God with everything. And we see this reminder here. As for me, I will call upon God. Also over in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. We've gone through this in a whole sermon on Hezekiah. I love this story. We're not going to go through it in depth. But 2 Chronicles, picking up in verse 31. Quite a bit is said about Hezekiah here. And you look at what he went through. cleaning out the Israel of all the garbage, all the idols, all of the pagan worship that should be thrown out and burned, and he did it. It had to be tough. But we see, picking up chapter 31, verse 20, it says, "Then thus Hezekiah did throughout all Judea. He did what was good and right and true before the Lord his God." That's where it has to start. You've got to do what God says. You've got to get rid of the idols. Verse 21, "And in every work that he began in the service of the house of God, in the law and in the commandments to seek his God, he did it with all his heart. So he prospered." Now, from the end of this sentence, period here, to the beginning of the next chapter, how many, I don't know if it's months that go by, if it was a year or more, but then you get surrounded by another force. You get surrounded by an army. Well, wait a second, I've been following God. I got rid of all the deities, I got rid of all the pagan, I even got rid of the high places. And now I've got armies around me. Armies that no one on this earth has ever beaten. The Assyrians never left hostages. You went against them, they killed every one of them, and they made it painful. They put you on a stake and let others see, here's what happens if you go against us. So now Hezekiah is going to say, no, we're following God. We're putting our trust in God. Sennacherib comes before and starts to mock them. Hezekiah gives them reassuring words. Sennacherib will try to mock these reassuring words. Dropping down to verse 7. Hezekiah says these words, "Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid nor dismayed before the king of Assyria, nor before all the multitude that is with him. For there are more with us than with them." Quite a statement. You wonder if he got it from Elisha, if you read some of those scrolls to remind him of that. Verse 8, "With him," talking of Sennacherib, the king of the Assyrians, "is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles." And the people were strengthened by the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. Didn't stop the king of Assyria mocking him, using these same words. You're going to hear this, but no one stood up against us. No one can beat the Assyrian army. You want to bet? But it had never been done. It's always interesting how God deals with his servants. He could have stopped the Assyrians 50 miles before they got there. Could have stopped the Syrians as they were coming up to Elisha. Turn them around. He lets them get right up to the door. Maybe it's a test. How are we going to handle it? Will we get scared and run? Will we look to God? Will we look to our own might? Where will we look? We see this with Hezekiah, quite an attitude. And he goes pointing right to God. There's more with us than there are with them. We've got to keep looking to God. That had to be a very tough trial for Hezekiah. Everyone is probably whispering in his ear, "Well, but no one's ever lived past the Assyrians. We've got to..." No, we don't. We have to follow God. But God stood by him every step of the way. He helped him with that army that surrounded. Also over in Revelation chapter 12. I wonder if we'll face similar things in end time events. We have these examples, people of faith that came before us. We have, the famous Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Never seen anyone go through a fire, never walked in one. But they looked up Nebuchadnezzar and said, "We're not bowing down to your idol. We choose to obey our God." They didn't know. They could have got thrown in there and died. They knew their next waking moment was in the kingdom, and they'd be teaching Nebuchadnezzar eventually. And we see this over and over, God's people standing up, going through it, not letting down. Revelation chapter 12, beginning in verse 13, talks about God's protection. Beginning here in verse 13 of Revelation 12, "Now when that dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth," again, these end time events, "he persecuted the woman, the church, who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place." And what we've gone through in another sermon, going through the place of safety, her place that's mentioned here. There's this protection that's given. I think sometimes we can think, oh, wow, that's just going to be a piece of cake. I wonder how many lessons we're going to learn through that. How many times maybe we're going to go through what the Israelites went through. 3 days of no water. Will we begin to murmur? Yeah, but I still got my garden back home. I want to go back. I bet there's still fruit in my garden. I could get food back there. Yeah, but God's protection's here. And he's guiding us. And he's seeing where is our faith. Where will we, you know, let down? You know, we see there's things that take place here. We see this place that she goes to her place where she is nourished for a time and a times and a half of times. 3.5 years. From the presence of the serpent. From the presence of Satan. How bad this society is going to be that we need that protection. And it may not look bad at first. But it will get bad. Verse 15, "So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood." You're talking about an insurmountable army? Whether this is actual water, it could be, but it says like a flood. Maybe it's an actual military force that comes out. Well, how dare they come here? They're not allowed in this area. And we get surrounded. Whether it's an army, whether it's actual water, it will look impossible. How will our faith be? Well, but I'm safe back in LaPorte. I'm safe back in Munster. Things were fine when we left. I want to go back. Or will we say, God, you're our only protection. We look to you. We need you. And we see this water coming out in verse 16, the earth helped the woman. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Well, we see this intervention. I find it interesting. It's not, well, you know, God took the water way back there, the army way back. How close does it get? How much of this standing and waiting is, okay, God, now? How about now? How about now? I'm trusting you. Can we have the earth open up now? But you put your faith in God. God protects his people. And we see this future event that will take place. And we see it's not just being protected in a place, that there will maybe still be times where someone will come out. But God's protection will be there. And quite a statement, and quite a lesson as we look at this story back in 2 Kings again. We look at this example of Elisha. I love his statement again here in verse 16. "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." God's protection is there. Elisha saw it. Elisha didn't back down. And he asked to help this young man in verse 17. And Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he said, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. We see here in verse 17 this 13th miracle. This sight to the blind. Sight given to this young man. This man who at this point lacked faith. I'm sure it helped build his faith, but we see this take place. I want to see what it was like. You start to picture here. We're outnumbered. God opening up his eyes and seeing the chariots and the horses on fire. Those of God's protection being there. I find it interesting as well that it says that the mountains was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Did it make the servant want to get closer to Elisha? Was the servant already thinking, where's the quickest exit? And Elisha says, God, help him to see. He sees the protection, and it's not around the servant. It's around Elisha. Well, I got to make sure I'm helping Elisha. I'm his servant. I'm to be serving Elisha. And so we see this attitude. We see this 13th miracle, his vision, his blindness being restored, seeing what God was there, that God was there, that protection. The miracles start falling in over and over here, and it seems to go with sight blindness. here we see sight given, and then we get to verse 18. So when the Syrians came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Strike this people, I pray, with blindness." And he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. I love his humor here. Here you have this mighty group of army here coming your way. And, you know, you wonder if they're starting to yell insults. They're coming at him. "Look at all of us. One, you little puny you. Two of you guys, cute. Include your servants." And then the next thing you see is, where is everything? They can't see. They're blind. All of a sudden they go from being prideful and we can do anything to now, where am I at? They're blind. We see this 14th miracle, smiting blindness, that's given to this army. Blindness to this army. God allows Elisha, I don't know, maybe God allows Elisha to have some fun. Because the rest of this part just cracks me up. Here you have this mighty, prideful army, and Elisha then says, "Okay, I'll lead you to the guy." And he's leading him, he's not lying, and he just keeps bringing him along. And we see here in verse 19, "Now Elisha said to them, 'This is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek.' But he led them to Samaria." Now, technically, he's not lying. He is leading them to him. It's just a long process. Maybe 10 miles, as you look at Dothan, is 10 miles north of Samaria. So for 10 miles, he's, just a little bit further, keep coming. And he keeps moving, and just a little bit further, keep coming. 10 miles of blindness. This wasn't a 10-minute trip. It took a little while to get there. Going through all this, you picture him kind of leading them by the hand in blindness. I want to see this. This is just cracks me up. Verse 20, "So it was when they had come to Samaria." Again, remember, Samaria is the capital of Israel. This is the biggest city, the biggest fortified area. This is the heavily fortified. You had the armies there. You're going to have protecting the king. The king is in here. And he brings them right into the gate. He brings them into Samaria that Elisha said, "Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see." And the Lord opened their eyes and they saw, and there they were inside Samaria, dead meat. We see here the 15th miracle, restoring their sight. The 15th miracle, restoring their sight here. Quite an awakening. You get to finally open your eyes after 10 miles, and now you are in the heart of it. I would think that you had archers around, you had other army of Israel all there ready. They open their eyes and boom. How would you feel? You're in the enemy's camp. You're in the enemy's capital city. We see verse 21. "Now when the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, 'My father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them?'" Maybe kind of a hurry. Should we kill them? Should we kill them? Maybe they'll start drawing their swords. Maybe they'll start fighting. Should we kill them? But there is a little bit of respect here. Is he starting to see? I don't know. We see later he doesn't. But we see the king of Israel. Maybe this was for him to see how he would do. But he calls Elisha my father, a term of respect. He calls him my father and he asks permission. He doesn't just, okay, time to kill him. God's given him to us. He asks Elisha, "Should I do this?" And he calls them father out of respect. Quite a statement. We won't turn back to all of them. You can put in your notes. We've looked at several already. 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 12, Elisha calls Elijah father in respect. Also last time in chapter 5, verse 13, the servants of Naaman call Naaman father out of that respect. One coming up, if you turn over to chapter 8, verse 9. Chapter 8, verse 9, we see Ben-Hadad himself call Elisha, father, in a roundabout way, I guess. We see here in 2 Kings 8, verse 8, Ben-Hadad sends Hazael, his servant, to Elisha. It says, take presents, take and ask, will I recover from this disease? Verse 9, so Hazael went to meet him and took a present with him of every good thing of Damascus, 40 camel loads. And he came and stood before Elisha and said, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent to you, saying, shall I recover from this disease? Quite a statement. The king saying, I'm the son to Elisha. Out of respect, I am looking to Elisha. He's my father in respect. Quite a statement for this king. Maybe this really humbled him in this disease he was going through. But he calls him out of respect, father, or that I'm your son to Elisha. Quite a statement. And so we see that from the king of Israel. Again, back in verse 21 of chapter 6, king of Israel asking permission. Going to Elisha, is it okay? He calls him father out of respect. But it's interesting the statement that he tells him. Verse 22, and he, Elisha, answered, you shall not kill them. Would you kill those whom you have taken captive with your sword and your bow? Set food and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master. That had to be a little shocking. Why in the world would you bring him here if we can't kill him? Well, there was a bigger message for them to learn. If you turn back to Matthew chapter 5, Christ covers this in his Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5. A principle that's tough to think of as a Christian. But as a Christian, we're to be learning this. I think it'll become even tougher with end time events. People that may throw us out of our houses, kill relatives. And we're told, you know, we know they're our enemies, but we're told, what are we to do? Verse 43, Matthew 5, verse 43, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Again, wrong. It doesn't say that anywhere in Scripture. Never says to hate your enemy. Verse 44, but I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. That's tough. Someone's cussing at you. You're not, oh, thank you. Appreciate it. You're a wonderful person. Thank you for using the F word with me. I'm kind of sadistic to one point. Occasionally you get the jerks driving and they'll give you the finger. I'll just wave and smile. And they'll, oh, no, I meant the finger. No, hi. I guess it's maybe not quite this way, but I have fun with it. Love your enemies, bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. That's tough. Someone that is spitefully doing it on purpose, wants you dead, persecuting you, and you're to pray for them. Really? Can I just kick them? I mean, really? No. We're to love our enemies. And why? Verse 45, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. We know the family we look to. There's a different standard with God and His family. For he makes his sun rise on the evil, on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore, you shall be perfect. Other translations, you shall become perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. You know, our overall main goal, to be like our Father. And here's how our Father treats others. You can think of yourself before you were called to God's truth. Would you think you're an enemy to God? You kept Christmas, you kept Easter, you didn't care about the Sabbath. Someone talked about God, whatever. And yet God still loved us while we were enemies. So you think, yeah, I guess I need to be learning that. It's not easy, but you look at Elisha here. He brings in this army. And he doesn't just say, let him go. He says, give him some water and food. What? Let him go eat dirt. They've been killing people. They've been taking people captive. They don't deserve this. Well, love your enemy. Well, we see that here. And again, back in 2 Kings chapter 6, it says, set food and water before them, in verse 22, that they may eat and drink and go to their master. The king listens, so you wonder if things are starting to get through to him. Then he prepared a great feast for them. And after they ate and drank, he sent them away. And they went to their master. I love this last statement here in verse 23. So the bands of Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. You think? They go back and these stories had to go around. What in the world? You guys couldn't see? You had one guy to go after. You couldn't bring back one guy? No. And they start telling the story. We went in there, piece of cake. All of a sudden we're blind. Elisha brings us into the middle of Samaria, and then they let us go. They could have easily killed us. Would you want to be the next raider? Yeah, I'll sign up to go back in. No. So they maybe learn something. They see this example. But we see quite a few miracles that happen through this section. Verses 8 through 24, verse 23, we see at least four miracles here leading up to the 15th miracle. One miracle left to be recorded. We'll cover that in the next one. Another kind of neat one, but it takes four or five chapters to get there. Actually happens after Elisha dies. And so you look at these miracles that he performs. We'll look at those next time, probably in 2 weeks as we finish this. Hopefully we'll get through it. It's interesting how much is still here without any recorded miracles from Elisha. Elisha comes back quite a bit, and it's not until chapter 13 where you get his last miracle, when he's dead. But up to this, there's a lot of going back, looking at the different kings and their examples, what they did. Some bloodthirsty kings, still seeing Ahab and Jezebel, their tentacles and things. And Elisha still standing up. Elisha still standing up for God's way, continually pointing to God. We look in this chapter, and there's a lot in it, even as we're just up to verse 23. But you start with looking at a simple axe. And here Elisha has a tender enough heart to say, yeah, let's get it back for you. And we still see a tender heart where, should we kill the army? No, give them food and water, let them go back. It'll be a good example. And we see a tender heart. We see Elisha, again, pointing to God. We see this relationship. Will these things happen? Some of these things happen in time events. God has a great way of dealing with Satan and his armies. And we see, well, over and over we're reminded, don't forget, those on your side are more than those who are on the other. God is always there, always helping protect, even when you are encircled about by trials, things that are insurmountable. And we look to God and all those things. It reminds us that relationship that has to continually be built. Elisha had that strong faith, and that faith that we must continually be working on. As we look at Elisha and those examples, those lessons, that we are to be developing in our life as well.